So I thought we would start off by asking the panelists to make some comments or respond to the four, I guess, pillars, Brian would have said, what you do after you read his book. What do you do? Because I feel like all these people have done most of these things or have plans to do them. And we'll have some good stories and insights to tell us about that. So the first one was to get proximate, get close to the broken people. Brian's book is organized around in his life, really, the theme that all of us are broken in some way. And that we, I guess Rabbi Ed's going to tell us we should do something toward repairing all these people. But Brian has four motions, movements, and plans that he thinks actions you should take. And the first one is to get close. Don't make them abstract at statistics, but get close. So how about, I guess we'll go from right to left first, and then right to left, and then I'll start in the middle.
Me first?
Sure.
All right, thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit about brokenness in not only in the system, but at us as individuals. I thought Brian's comments about how we're all broken and the recognition of that fact is really important and really touches home. We really are broken, all of us, in individual ways. But brokenness also can lead to healing, of course. And it's without recognizing where you need to be fixed. That's where we run into difficulties. We were talking last night here. We had a book group study, and we were talking about some of the recent rhetoric that we've all seen on TV and Charlottesville and everything, and this idea that the people that are so angry, at least one group of people that are so angry, we've lost our country. We need to take our country back. We need to get and that the brokenness is just right there. You can just see it. You can feel it in those words. They may not recognize it. They think they're being cheated. They may not recognize it, but it is a sense that there's something wrong. There's something that bothers. And there's something that bothers all of us. I think I was a public defender for so long, and I know the rabbi is going to speak to this too. And, of course, it's all but obvious to talk about how broken our clients are. And we're going to talk about hope a little bit later. And so many of them are out of hope. And then when they find they've been appointed a public defender, so many times they're even become more hopeless because everyone knows public defenders are overworked and overtaxed and don't care much about their clients. And, of course, many times the opposite of that is true. But there's a sense of that. When you visit a client in jail, if you've never been to a jail or a prison, it's a very difficult thing. We talked about that as well last night. The visits can mean so much, even 20 minutes, even once a week, much less twice a week. And it means so much to those folks. And what they want is to talk about their case, certainly, but also about their lives. And they're hoping that someone will fight for them and someone will advocate for them, not just from a legal perspective, but get to know them and find out what it is that really makes them tick and why they're there in the first place, how they get to be in jail, prison, charged, or convicted with a serious enough crime. That they're facing incarceration for many, many years. So we need to recognize that in our clients. We need to recognize that in ourselves. I had the great opportunity to serve on the Governor's Commission, the OPD Commission, which is always underfunded and is always looking for reform. And as you travel around the state and meet the public defenders, it's the first question I learned to ask them is, how's the morale of the office? And they don't use the word broken, but it's always broken. It's always down. The morale is down because where are we going to get the funds? I don't have enough hours in a day. There's too many cases. And it comes back to not that they feel that the work they're doing is not valuable, because they do, but they feel with the lack of resources and time and the money, they can't do the job for their clients. They become public defenders because they want to. So public defenders themselves. We also talked a little bit about, last time, we'll talk again today, about judges or prosecutors. Prosecutors get elected in Montana, and I suspect in most places. They don't get elected by saying we're going to fix brokenness. They don't get elected by saying we're going to work on parole plans and probation plans. Not very often do you hear that. They work because it's going to be tough on crime. And there's an unwritten law in Montana, and I suspect in many other places, that prosecutors become judges. And judges get elected. And when there's opening on the Montana Supreme Court, like there is right now, believe me, those folks are talking, and they know who's been a good judge and who's been a good prosecutor and who's going to, if you saw the paper and the story in the paper today, you get the feeling, this is very, very true, that there's sort of an inside group and those folks are talking. And I can tell you who the favorite is to be the new Montana Supreme Court Justice because I've heard in legal circles. And that all that is not recognized, I don't think, as well by most prosecutors. But if you think about it, is that not a sense of being broken? They're elected to do something. They're further their career. Well, prosecutors will be the first to tell you that they're out for fairness and equity, and that's why they became prosecutors. But there's another component to it as well. But there's another component. So I'm really interested in those types of things and talk about our system in Montana. And when I get the floor a little bit later, I'll talk about some of our cases and listen to these fine folks. I think it should be a good morning.
Mm-hmm. I do want to talk about proximity a lot. It's really, really important, especially to me as a black person. It's very important to anybody who has melanated skin, who's LGBTQ, who's Muslim, who's Jewish, that people really get to know us, who are part of the historically disenfranchised and marginalized and oppressed peoples here in this country. And I tell people right off the bat, right from the beginning, that it is up to white people to fix our racist system, because black people, brown people, native people have been working on it for centuries. We're not the ones who hold the power. It is white people who hold the power. So if you're white and if you don't realize that, it's probably because you haven't had enough proximity. Okay, so, and I'm not saying that you need to get to know somebody who is culturally different from you to do that just because they're culturally different from you. It's really important that you just get to know people who are different from you as friends, as a normal person, not as someone who is just culturally different. Just you need to recognize us as being normal people. But we do have different experiences from white people just because of the color of our skin. And so we see life differently. I like to tell people that this one example of a good friend of mine who about a year ago moved to South Carolina, and she showed me, she emailed me a picture of this beautiful, beautiful old growth tree that was just, the canopy was beautiful and had these big broad limbs that started like low to the ground and just worked their way up, and she goes, isn't this a beautiful picture? And it's this tree that's in my yard or in a park near where I live here in South Carolina. And I told her, my first thought as soon as I opened that picture, knowing that that tree was in South Carolina, is wondering how much strange fruit had hung from the limbs. How many black people had been hung on that tree? And it shocked her when I told her that. But that's my perspective, given the historical background of my people, that's the first thing that I would see. That's another reason, by the way, for bringing in people from all sorts of different backgrounds to work in businesses, to be in schools, to be in, particularly in advertising and marketing and all those, because we have a different perspective. So part of my background is, for 13 years I was in law enforcement, and believe me, I got very proximate to people. I worked in a wealthy area that had plenty of poorer areas around it. So, and for 2 years I was a juvenile detective working crimes against kids and crimes committed by kids. And one of the things that we did, we had a program where we worked with juvenile probation. As a matter of fact, we had a juvenile probation officer whose office was right next to mine, and we did a lot of diversion. And one of the things that I really want to focus on with this panel is the school-to-prison pipeline and restorative justice in the schools. And we'll talk about that from preschool all the way up through high school and into college, about the school-to-prison pipeline, how that feeds, how that is so unjust. So that's just something that I can give to that. And I'm really looking forward to talking with you more and hearing more from my co-panelists.
Yeah, so brokenness. I'm not sure which. I'm not sure if I should be wearing my rabbi's hat or my lawyer's hat to answer this. So the rabbi's hat, just for 1 minute, and that will be about our own personal brokenness. So we're coming up upon the Jewish High Holiday. It starts September 21st. The whole High Holiday month that we're in, of Elul, is all about coming to understand our own brokenness and repairing it. And what Judaism offers is essentially, in this time of year, a spiritual technology that's too complicated to explain right here, but in order to take you from, or at least to root out some of that brokenness, to identify some of it, and to heal some of it. But so that's all I'm going to say about that, and I'll take off my rabbi's hat and go back to my years as a trial lawyer and as a criminal defense lawyer. I started practicing in 1977, and that was the same year, or a year before, when the United States Supreme Court had declared the death penalty unconstitutional. For the whole nation. But in the couple of years that followed, there were some new Supreme Court appointees. States started revising their death penalty statutes, and it went up again to the United States Supreme Court. And I believe that the first two cases where it was upheld were Georgia and Florida. And what shifted, what the argument, the reason it was upheld in theory, was that all mitigation could now be considered. And so what happens in a capital case is, first the person is tried, and if they're found guilty of first-degree murder, you go into a penalty phase. And the penalty phase, every state has what's called aggravating factors, and the prosecutor will try to prove these aggravating factors, whatever they may be, bad criminal history, or the crime was committed a especially heinous way, or whatever they are. And then there's mitigating factors. And the mitigating factors, there's some of them are set out, but the crucial thing that the Supreme Court said is that you can't limit mitigating factors. That anything that could conceivably be mitigating can be used. And so that was the point of time, within a year or two of that case, that I first became involved in death penalty work. And there was no precedent for any of this. It was all brand new. We were inventing it as we went along. And one of the first things we did, I worked with a woman named Charlotte Holdman, blessed memory, who passed away just a couple of weeks ago in California. And Charlotte was just this diehard friend of death row inmates who would go around. At that time, you didn't get a lawyer. You got a lawyer at trial and at appeal, but no lawyers after that. And so she would find volunteer lawyers to take on these cases at such time as a governor would sign a death warrant. And that's how she got me involved. She showed up at my house one night with a bottle of wine, and it was like the angel of death, because I knew that the next year of my life was going to be totally committed to a pro bono death penalty case. But we were really inventing the process as we went along. And one of the things we did, there's much that we did, but is we created this this job called mitigation specialist. These were people who, Charlotte was the first one, actually. And eventually we developed a whole slew of them. People, generally they were social workers or some related field. And their job was to find out everything about this child, about this person, from the time they were born until now. Their job was to make the defense lawyer so intimate, so proximate with this person, that you were no longer advancing the mitigation of some stranger, but somebody who was a member of your family. Every teacher, every physician, every friend, every neighbor was thoroughly interviewed. And we often found patterns like head injuries, like child abuse. And it wasn't easy to find these things because very often people didn't want to talk about them. I remember one case where the man The defendant had been abused as a child. And the question was, how do you present that in a way that's real, that makes it proximate for the people who are having to judge? And we actually got a film, a documentary. This is like in the 80s. I can barely remember the details. But this film showed child abuse going on in a home in the most graphic way. That when the man slapped the kid, you recoiled like this as viewing the film. You thought it was coming at you. And that totally changed how the jurors, or in this case actually it was a judge, understood what this man had been through for years as a child. To put ourselves in that place. And in all the... Frankie said I did 150 cases. I actually probably did twice that many if you count the ones that I consulted on. Because when I did the Volunteer Lawyers Resource Center, what we were doing at that time is finding volunteer lawyers from around the country who'd come take these cases pro bono, but I would hold their hands. And sometimes I'd have to hold their hands just a little, and sometimes I'd have to hold their hands a lot, because I'd been in those trenches. And these were good lawyers, but they just hadn't done this kind of work before. So I did so many of those that I was involved in at different levels of involvement. And this was our main focus, was humanizing, if you like, proximatizing the individual. And at all that time, we didn't lose a single client, to execution. And it's all about making it personal. That was my experience. And I think that's still, unfortunately, if you don't have a... So we got to the point that the court would pay, or the county would have to pay for the services of these mitigation specialists, but only in capital cases. So if you have a case where someone's looking at life, you don't get that, at least unless things have changed, I don't know. But that was the case back then. In a way, you were better off being charged with a death penalty offense because you got these resources that other people didn't get. I was always fond of saying capital punishment means he with the capital don't get the punishment. If you could afford this stuff, if you could afford this stuff. A lot of the ones I did were not pro bono, but were paid. And if we had the resources to do this kind of thing, we could make everybody proximate. But we don't always have the resources.
You know, I think I've heard you say exactly the quote from Brian's book, each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. Because your whole strategy was to get the judge and jury to see the broader context of the person's life.
And this is, by the way, I think now common, right? But at that time it was, as I said, we were flying by the seat of our pants.
Right. I distinctly remember arresting somebody for drunk driving, and it was a woman who, she was great. I thought, oh, geez, you know, we could be buddies, you know. But she was so drunk she'd wrecked her car. I had to take her to jail, you know. But it's just, you get to know, oftentimes you get to know these people who, the cops who you arrest because of some, you know, conversation, and you find out some about them, and they're, you know, really nice people who have made a mistake. They are definitely more than the crime that they've committed. No question.
Caitlin, proximity.
Yeah, it's so hard to know where to start. I wanted to mention two others. So Rabbi Ed raised the issue of the correlation of poverty or the effect of poverty on whether people enter the criminal justice system, whether they get the death penalty, whether they ever get out of the criminal justice system. And so I hope we'll get to talk more about that. It's obviously very closely correlated with race everywhere, including in Montana. And I have a story that intertwines those two that I hope to be able to tell you later. I also wanted to mention that, another marginalized group that is especially affected when we're talking about criminal justice, and that's disabled persons, especially people with mental illness. And I do have a short letter that I'm going to read you about, and we have cases that we are currently litigating in the and have litigated this issue in the past in the ACLU of Montana in terms of how guilty but mentally ill prisoners are treated in the Montana correction system and in the state hospital. It's hard as a white person in Montana to get proximate to these issues, I think, especially issues of race, because we have so few people of color in Montana. I grew up in Missoula, and honestly, it was like living in a bubble. I really had no concept of the kinds of discrimination, structural racism, implicit bias, individual, just straight up individual racism that people of color, including Native Americans in Montana, experience. And, you know, there's different levels of proximity. So at the ACLU, we have been prioritizing we have two main priorities. We cover a huge waterfront of issues, and so we just have to figure out, okay, we're going to prioritize a couple of them. We'll always work on all of them, but if we want to move the ball forward, we can't focus on all of them to the same degree. So the two that we prioritized over the next 4 years are what we call the criminalization of poverty. In particular, right now, we're focusing on looking at the probation and parole system, because a huge percent of, it's something like 83% of people in the Montana prison system are incarcerated for parole or probation revocations. So we're looking at that. And then our second issue is racial justice. And a big issue that we're focusing on is education equity, because, you know, one of the things about getting proximate in Montana is you can't, and, you know, racial justice for us is all issues, but we have a specific focus on Indigenous justice, and we stole away Meg's volunteer, wonderful volunteer Meg Singer, to be our Indigenous justice outreach coordinator. And Meg has been traveling the state and visiting reservations. I can't tell you how many times she's traveled to Wolf Point. I mean, she was in Helena. She now lives in Missoula. So, I mean, you know, it's like an 8-hour drive or something like that to Wolf Point. So, but you got to be in the communities, or you can't do this work, right? We're really committed to working with the communities and hearing from them what issues they want to address, and then help empowering them to address these issues. So we're not just, you know, parachuting in, doing a lawsuit and leaving. It's not sustainable. We've done lawsuits. We filed a lawsuit in Wolf Point over the, you know, districting, the incredibly racially disparate districting of the school board, and fixed it. In quotes, right? Because now there are 3 Native people out of 6 on the school board, but it really didn't change anything, because that, you know, racism is so insidious. That is not going to fix everything. So that was in 2014. So now we're working with the community to train them in the tools of activism so that they can help make sure that, so that they can advocate for changes, and so that they can make sure that that stays as administrations change and the years pass. So, you know, I think this, for me, the issue of proximity as a white person is very overlapping with the fourth one, which is putting yourself in uncomfortable situations and places. So I'll save some of that for the uncomfortable part of the conversation. But I do think for white people, getting proximate is getting uncomfortable. It's just every time I talk about race, I run a severe risk of putting my foot in my mouth, saying something stupid, making people angry, and too bad. You know, I just have to do it, and sometimes it's really, really hard. I have been told, actually, at various times, that I need to talk about race in less stark terms, that I need to use the term Anglo instead of whites, because whites will be offended if I talk about the really egregious racism that whites have exhibited historically, but continue to.
That's white fragility. That's white fragility, just to let you know.
That is white fragility. And how many of you are familiar with the term white fragility? I bet you're not a representative audience. But if you're not, I have a really good, super short article that I'd be happy to email you if you come to me afterwards. I forget the name of the scholar who coined that term, but it's just like a 2-pager. It's really great to read. It's really great, if you're already familiar with the term, to pass along to friends who don't know about it.
Robin D'Angelo. Robin D'Angelo.
Yes, thank you. Robin D'Angelo. Anyway, so enough of that. One thing that Judith mentioned before this started, before the panel started, that I thought was really insightful is that because it's hard for people to get proximate, particularly, like, how many people have either worked for, volunteered in, or just visited one of the Montana prisons or jails, or doesn't have to be in Montana? Okay, fewer people, right? And it's not necessarily easy to find opportunities to do that. I mean, you can, and it'd be wonderful if you did, but I took a tour of the Montana State Prison, and honestly, what I'm going to read you here, you know, it was like the Animal House tour, you know? It's like, we don't have solitary confinement in Montana. We have ADSEG, administrative segregation, which in my view, and from my limited understanding, is just an utter euphemism for solitary confinement. I mean, there is a definition of solitary confinement, an accepted definition, and from what I can tell, everything they do in Montana meets it. So we get tons of letters from prisoners in Montana complaining about prison conditions, and they're really difficult to read. We can't take all the cases. There's no way. And, you know, the ACLU is committed to doing systemic change, so we generally do what we call impact litigation. We don't just represent individuals unless we can achieve some broader impact just because of resources. So this letter is someone complaining, not for himself, but on behalf of someone else. And we got it last year. It was addressed to our then staff attorney, who's retired, John Ellingson. Dear Mr. Ellingson, and I've anonymized the names. My name is John Doe. This letter is concerning the treatment of mentally ill prisoners locked in locked housing units 1 and 2, solitary confinement, of the Montana State Prison. Approximately 1 year ago, I was the swamper in LHU 1. While I worked in LHU 1, an inmate with severe mental health issues, I'll call him Richard Rowe, was subjected to the worst living treatment conditions I have ever witnessed. The ISO cell is a padded cell with a Chinese toilet hole in the floor, which can only be flushed from the outside of the cell. I have personally witnessed staff refuse to flush Mr. Rowe's toilet for days at a time and laugh about the overwhelming smell of feces. There is no sink in the ISO cell, and Mr. Rowe had to ask for a drink of water. I have witnessed staff deny Mr. Rowe water for hours at a time, then force him to beg for a drink of water. The temperature in this ISO cell is unbearably hot. On one occasion, after Mr. Rowe spent over a month in this ISO cell, I was forced to clean it out. The smell can only be described as a filthy dog kennel. I vomited due to the smell. Mr. Rowe was repeatedly denied mental health treatment. I witnessed Mr. Rowe on one occasion bite the webbing between his thumb and index finger and pack it full of his feces after spending a month in the ISO cell, over a month. Mr. Rowe has bit the arteries out of his arms in attempts to commit suicide. I have watched staff members encourage Mr. Rowe to kill himself and comment that if they found him bleeding out, they would let him die. After being subjected to these barbaric living conditions for several years, Mr. Rowe recently committed suicide by jumping headfirst off of the second tier. Mr. Rowe's death was preventable. The staff in LHU 1 and 2 drove him to suicide. I'm having a real difficult time living with myself for I did not see anything out of terror of retaliation. Remorsefully, John Doe.
You just made us all proximate, Caitlin. Mm-hmm. Instead of, we have three more things to talk about. If we go straight through, you won't ever get to ask questions. What if you ask questions about this one issue, proximity, if you have any questions or comments that you want to hear more from?
Well, I have a comment, or maybe even a story. I lived, I was born and raised in New York, Westchester, New York, sort of upstate. If you live in New York, it's considered upstate. But if you don't live in New York, it's the city. And I joined the military when I was 21 years old. And my first base was in Grand Forks, North Dakota. So, your story about the proximity really struck me because it's, I don't know, 99% of the population, 99.7% of the population is white. And I experienced an awakening, if you will, because coming from New York, you experience subtle racism. You know what's happening. But this was blatant. I was more aware of my own blackness, if you will. It was not as apparent in New York as it was here. And I worked in a few places, and one of those places I was a photographer at a photo shop. We did film, developed pictures and things like that, and we had a studio there. And every time somebody would walk through that door and see me as the photographer, they could be laughing and smiling, and oh, so excited to take pictures, and the second they saw me, that smile was gone. So fast. And I tried, well, most of the time I didn't get upset about it because of the proximity. I did understand that these folks don't hardly ever see black folks, ever. and it's uncomfortable. It's different, it's strange, it's all of these things. And after a while of getting to talk to them and work with them in the studio, I get smiles and laughs, and they're walking out, and they're just as happy as can be. Because now they've had this experience, even though it was on a professional level, but it was still an experience. But one time I had someone come in that wanted their pictures taken, and they came with the rebel flag. They wanted to take their picture, their family picture, with their rebel flag. And I, you know, hey, let's get in there and do this. But their girl, they had a girl, she's about 12, between 12 and 14, refused. No, I'm not letting her take my picture. The family was embarrassed by her behavior, even though they're the reason she was acting that way. And it was sad to me. More than anything, it was just sad that this little girl had these kinds of thoughts and feelings about someone she didn't even know. And but I did, I got the picture, and she even smiled. And maybe she walked away with a different view of at least one black person. I don't know about all, but maybe one. So for me, getting upset would not have solved this. Not any time that I was in North Dakota would it have solved it, because these folks don't know black folks. They've never been around them. And I can't really blame them for that. I have to do my part to break down those barriers, break down those walls, break down those stereotypes and whatever. You know, I got my taste, if you will, of proximity as well. I learned a lot of lessons too. So it was a worthwhile experience. I'm glad I was there. I got my degree there. I was there for 11 years in North Dakota and loved it and still have some great friends there. But I think if I didn't have that experience, I would have a different way of thinking about these subtle racisms, these subtle actions and words and things that people say, not intentionally by any means, sometimes very intentionally, but most of the time not. I think I would have a different take on it.
Thank you. So
thank you
for sharing that.
Thank you very much.
Yep. Question or comment about proximity?
And to your point, my husband's from rural North Dakota, and he never met anybody who was black or Hispanic until he went to college. So it was a learning experience for him, and then the Air Force more so, because our military is very diverse. What kind of opportunities do we have for proximity in Bozeman? That's a question that I have.
Well, you know, there's the university has a number of, well, at least last year, there were like 650 Native American students. There's a large and thriving Native American Studies department. There, last year, there were about 160 African American students at the university. I don't know what the stats are this year yet. There are quite a few international students. There's a the Office of International Programs has a Bozeman Friends of International Students program, BFIS, where and they should probably be advertising it very soon, where people can take under their wing an international student from any number of countries. There's something like 23 different countries, I think, that are represented at MSU this year. To get to know people whose culture is different than your own. There are a lot of black people in Bozeman. If you pay attention, you'll see us around. We work. We go to the grocery store. We go to the movies. We walk downtown. You know, all these kinds of things. And, you know, if we're picking out some fruit in the grocery aisle, say hi. You know, how you doing? Nice day, isn't it? And, you know, just... And if you strike up a conversation, you strike up a conversation. If you go to Five Guys Pizza or Five Guys Burgers or whatever, any or Starkey's or any place where you can choose where you want... Starkey's not a place where you can actually choose where you want to sit, but where you can actually choose where you want to sit, say the co-op, either downtown or across from the high school. You get your meal, you sit down, and there aren't very many seats available, but I can guarantee you that if there's a black person or a native person sitting at a table for four and they're the only person sitting there, that was a decision by all the white people to not sit with that person. Sit with that person. Choose that seat. Choose that seat. And if a conversation happens, a conversation happens. Why? That's called self-segregation. Flip the script. Don't fall for that. You know, don't fall for that. If you go to a Hawks football game and or any football game and you see, you know, the black people sitting together, well, they're sitting together because there's solidarity in that. You know, you don't have to worry about somebody saying something demeaning to you on purpose or unintentionally. But if you're walking past them to go sit with people of your own kind, what does that say about you? That you're not interested in getting proximate? And besides that, you know, I got to tell you, the black section is the most fun section. Okay. But, you know, just sit there and just say hi, you know, or whatever. Just, you're joining in. Make it happen. If you don't get proximate, if you don't make the effort to get proximate, it's not going to happen. I would not advise you to come up to me in the grocery store and go, "Hi, black person, I'd like to get to know you." Don't reach out and touch my hair if I have it in a fro or in braids. That's a serious microaggression, and I might break your arm by pushing you back, you know, with my forearm. You know, those kinds of things. So, yes.
One more question.
Go. Yeah, I have a couple other ideas as far as becoming involved with proximity, and I agree with you that the university is a good place to start, but it's hard to volunteer up there. I worked for the TRIO program up there for over 16 years, and this is a program that serves for first generation or low income and disabled. And so I was around a lot of diversity working with that program, but we never actually asked for people to come in and volunteer. However, the Bozeman Public Schools is a big matter. There's a program through Thrive called CAP, Child Advancement Program, in which you can volunteer to be a mentor to students. And we do have students, if you actually are in the schools, get out there and see, you know, where the schools are that have the diversity, you're going to find Whittier is one, and Irving is another one. Irving is the one that's closest to the university. So you could volunteer for the CAP program and that you have to be in one of those schools. And then you get a couple of you know, to get to know some of the kids that are coming up.
Thank you. I think Rabbi has a quick comment.
Yeah. So we've been talking mostly about racial diversity, but there's also religious diversity. And we actually have a lot of programs going on that serve that end. The Gallatin Valley Interfaith Association meets the second Wednesday of every month, not in the summer, but our first meeting is in the second Wednesday of and everyone's invited to that. You have to check on it rotates around different facilities. But the first Wednesday of every month, which will be next Wednesday, is what we call the Interfaith Panel. And there's representatives of anywhere between 4 and 6 religious traditions. Each one spends 5 minutes discussing whatever the topic is that month, and then there's an audience of usually about 100 people from all sorts of religious backgrounds. And the Gallatin Valley Interfaith Association sponsors a wide variety of programs. Just last month, we had this thing called Walk with Sam, where many churches and synagogues and the mosque were open, and people kind of did a hopping around from one to the other. And in each one, there was a show and tell and opportunity for questions. So we have a very strong structure, existing structure, to promote religious diversity here. And includes, by the way, not just Jews and Christians and Muslims, but Buddhists, Unitarians, Mormons, Quakers, and a few other religious traditions as well. So that's we have that here.
So I'm going to start with Judaism.
Yeah.
And since you started talking about changing the narrative already, that's his second recommendation to us, is change the narrative. Comments from each panelist about that?
Well, I would like to talk about changing the narrative from a school-to-prison pipeline thing. How many in here do not know what the term school-to-prison pipeline means? Please raise your hand. All right, thank you. That gives me an idea of how I need to talk about this. The school-to-prison pipeline has to do with kids beginning from preschool being disciplined enough so that they end up, whether they deserve the discipline or not, whether they actually did something that deserves discipline or not, They end up becoming that person who is always getting in trouble. Now, know that if you are black or brown or native, that even from the time that you are 3 years old, you are seen as older and more responsible. A three-year-old, oftentimes people think, should have the judgment of a 5 to 7-year-old. And so they are treated as such while they're in school. Timur Rice, who was playing with a toy gun in Ohio, was 12 years old. And the cop who shot him within 2.5 seconds of arriving on the scene said that he thought he was 20. You know, this is another thing that has to do with proximity. You have to understand that that people judge that... That there's this thing where white people tend to think that brown people are older and more responsible than they really are, than they really should be for their age. The Washington Post in 2014, in July 24th, 2014, had an article that was written, it's first person, by a black woman named Tunette Powell, and the headline, "My son has been suspended 5 times. He's 3 in Washington, D.C. And this is so... You can look up this article on the Washington Post website. I love to cite this because black families, the subtitle, "Black Families Fight Entrenched Prejudices to Get Fair Discipline for Their Children in School." And one of the things that she really struggled with was her child really doing something wrong? But she knew that her child really hadn't done anything wrong. Her child was 3. You know, 3-year-olds do things that should be disciplined as a 3-year-old thing. And she said she would blame herself. But anyway, she went to a birthday party for one of his classmates. Her son's name was JJ. At the party, the mothers congregated to talk about everyday parenting things, including preschool. As we talked, I admitted that JJ had been suspended 3 times. All of the mothers were shocked at the news. JJ, one mother asked, my son threw something at a kid on purpose, and the kid had to be rushed to the hospital, another parent said. All I got was a phone call. We have to change the narrative on this stuff. And what happens is it's going to be in her son's record, in his school record, that he got suspended 5 times by the time he was 3. And this is going to continue on. His teachers are going to say, oh, this is a troublemaker. And they're going to keep their eye on that child. And the school resource officer is going to get called. And more and more and more, there are all sorts of statistics from studies. Black preschool children are 3.6 times as likely to receive one or more out-of-school suspensions as white preschool children. Black children represent 19% of preschool enrollment, but 47% of preschool children receiving one or more out-of-school suspensions. In comparison, white children represent 41% of preschool enrollment, but 28% of preschool children representing one or more out-of-school suspensions. So, and then it's, and black girls get it more. Black boys represent 19% of male preschool enrollment, but 45% of male preschool children receiving one or more out-of-school suspensions. But black girls represent 20%, but yet 54% of the female preschool children receiving one or more out-of-school suspensions. We're called sassy. That's, instead of, instead of bold, where, there are these names that are applied to children with melanated skin that are not applied to white children. There are definite programs that are available. You can check your school. You can check your school's policy. I have four or five handouts here that you can take. I don't know. Maybe the library can photocopy these for you or whatever. But these are some things that you want to consider. Are your school's policies fair? Dress and hair codes, because they really affect Native children, boys in particular, who wear their hair long as tradition, or put it in braids as tradition, and yet in a white school that is looked down upon and is seen as messy. Little girls wearing afros or putting their hair in great cornrows or braids or something is seen as messy and is seen as too stylish and is seen as unfair, and so they get disciplined for it. Know that these are things that you have to educate yourselves. This narrative has to be changed. It definitely has to be changed. Utah has some terrible statistics about Native students and how much they have been. Native American students in Utah are 4 times more likely to receive disciplinary action than white students. And this was a report from May 30th of just this year on a study that was done. And what's interesting is the school districts were doing a really serious work on trying to reduce the number of disciplinary actions on students, and they did reduce the number of disciplinary action on students for white students. So you can take a look and find that if you just do a search for Native American students in Utah disciplinary action, you'll find that on Google. So there is a report by a publication by the National Women's Law Center that talks about how we can build better, fairer schools, and there's a PDF about all these statistics and things like that. And this particular one has to do with girls, and particularly girls of color, Muslim girls, things like that, and how schools are unfairly pushing girls out. So, and I can talk more about that later, but I just wanted to say this is really, really important to change the narrative as far as Black and Brown and Native kids being seen as troublemakers. Thank you.
Rabbi Ed?
So we know the data in schools, in the criminal justice system, in the death penalty, and it's, you know, overwhelmingly shows disparate racial treatment. And one of the things I've always been interested in is why? What is the narrative that's driving this? And for a while I thought, well, maybe school administrators and judges and prosecutors are racists. But my experience is, while you do occasionally run into that, that they're not out to harm Black children or Indian children or anything like this. So I had, if I could tell an anecdote about two cases I had back in the 80s, right at the same time, it opened my eyes. The first one was a young white woman, newly married to a Colombian man, who was about 21 years old, wore all sorts of gold, and bragged to everyone who would listen that he's a big cocaine dealer. The truth is, however, he never dealt any cocaine, didn't even know where to get to cocaine, but he liked that image. There were a couple of guys who were about to be sentenced in an unrelated thing, and they needed to turn witness state's evidence against somebody in order to reduce their own sentence. And they had heard rumors about this guy who claimed to be a big cocaine dealer. And so they went to him and they talked to him. And he said, oh, yeah, I could get you all sorts of cocaine when I go to Colombia, blah, blah, blah. And but nothing ever happened. And their time was running out to get a reduced sentence. They went back to his home and he went there. He was visiting his parents in Colombia. And they spoke to his wife, Tammy, this young, very attractive white woman. They said, we've got to reach Carlos. It's really important. We got to set up this cocaine deal. Can you help us reach him? This was before the internet. And they had to go to some kind of international place where you could make international calls. And she helped them contact Carlos. And Carlos said, yeah, I could bring you some cocaine when I get back, and set up hundreds of pounds of cocaine deal with these guys, which never happened because Carlos didn't know how to get any cocaine. And Carlos never came back to the United States because he was indicted for conspiracy to distribute cocaine, even though he never actually did it. But Tammy was also indicted for that same conspiracy, simply for helping these guys make a phone call to reach Carlos. Case number two. I'll tell you what happened to Tammy in a second. A young Black woman, very much up and coming in Tallahassee, Florida, where I was living, hung out in the Black community with the lawyers and the doctors and the university professors. She owned her own home, but she rarely lived there because she lived with her boyfriend mostly. She had a sister who lived in South Florida, and the sister's boyfriend would apparently come up to Tallahassee sometimes to deal drugs, and he did it out of her house. There was a dispute. Some guys who bought from the brother-in-law said that she was present one time and saw it happen. She says, I didn't see it happen. Whatever, we're not sure. But the evidence against her that for which she would be indicted was that she allowed her house to be used. No evidence, nobody ever claimed that she was actively involved in actually selling the cocaine, but she was also indicted for conspiracy. As you can see, both of these women are very similarly situated. They're both women who only marginally assisted in a cocaine deal, if that. And both were indicted at the same time, and both were charged under the law that required a mandatory minimum of 10 years in federal prison because of the amount of cocaine involved. Okay, Tammy's case. In the criminal justice system, especially in federal court, there are a number of officials who get input. There's the prosecutor, of course, there's the probation officer, the judge's law clerks even sometimes have say, the judges obviously, and every one of those people that I spoke to in Tammy's case, you could see, it was obvious, that they saw Tammy as their daughter, their wife, their sister, or depending on their age and social status, they said they were so sympathetic because they realized all she did is try to help these guys reach her husband. And ultimately, they pulled all sorts of strings and let her plead guilty to using a telephone call in connection with a crime for which she got 3 years probation. The other woman, the black woman, went to the same people, and they all had the same story. We feel so sorry for her. We know that she did, you know, her involvement was minimal, but the law is the law. And sorry, I mean, the law is the law. It says 10 years minimum. We certainly are not going to ask for more than the 10 years minimum, but we don't really have any choice. The law is the law. And nobody could see her as their sister, their mother, their daughter, their cousin, whatever it was. And I think that's largely how this institutionalized racism works. Yes, I mean, you do run into people who, I had a judge one time call my client a nigger. You know, pardon my French. But, I mean, you do run into that once in a while. But mostly it's this, who you can identify with. If you can identify with this with somebody, they're a member of your tribe, they're a member of... you can see them as your family. There's a desire to help them. But if they seem like the other, then it's not that there's a desire to harm them. It's just that, well, nothing I can do. Law is the law. So that for me was a really eye-opening case. And that's the narrative we have to change. Yes, we have to change the narrative of the overt racist, but that's hard. That's really hard. But this narrative... it's maybe even harder to change. But that's really the narrative that's driving this, in my opinion.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think that was a really good illustration of the relationship between getting proximate and changing the narrative. It's so hard to change it when people are not proximate. I wanted to pick up on some of the things Judith was talking about with education equity. So as I had mentioned before, or the school-to-prison pipeline is one piece of it. I had mentioned before that we are focusing on that in our Indigenous justice work at the ACLU of Montana. And certainly those statistics about Native kids are equally true in Montana. We've contracted out to a researcher who is currently doing a report that should be done soon. When it's done, we'll be publishing it, and it will have statistics on children of color in Montana and the disproportionate discipline rates, among other things. I know from going to Wolf Point and talking to parents and from the work that we've done there that there certainly are disparities in discipline in terms of in-school and out-of-school suspensions, expulsions, and death, corporal punishment of Native kids. And a lot of times I hear, well, you know, is it correlated to poverty and, you know, chemical dependency issues and things like that? Well, undoubtedly that's some of it, right? If a kid comes to school and they haven't had an adequate meal, you know, things like that, the teachers may not be aware of that or know how to deal with it, and then it becomes a discipline issue when it really shouldn't. But, you know, stories like the one Judith told about, you know, this two kids getting in a fight, a white kid and a Native kid, and you know, there being really no difference in how they act. Or a lot of times we've heard stories of the Native kid just reporting on misbehavior by white students, and then the Native kid is the one that gets punished and the white students don't. So there is disparity even when circumstances are similar. One of the things that I think a lot of people, I certainly didn't really ever have any awareness of this in Montana, is that most of the schools in Montana on reservations are state-run public schools. And in some towns like Wolf Point, there's a significant white population in the school. So the town of Wolf Point is like 40-something percent white. But white people have for generations controlled the local economy, the school administration. They've held the coaching positions. Their kids get the Plum scholarships. They get the, you know, positions on the basketball teams. And so it's even the kids who should be thriving in school, who are not getting into trouble, who are getting good grades, their parents or grandparents or family members are supportive and engaged, feel that the environment is so hostile that many times the parents just end up pulling them out and sending them to the predominantly Native schools, you know, not a short distance away in Fraser and Poplar, you know, where they're not going to be subjected to that kind of hostility. We signed on to a complaint to the Department of Justice that you can find on our website that has stories about what it's like for kids in the Wolf Point school system, Native kids. That school district was already investigated by the Department of Education in 2004, and this is just an example of how, you know, reforms, that was from an outside group, and it just, it did, the reforms didn't stick. You know, some things were changed, but they mostly reverted back, which is why we're doing the community organizing to try to get the reforms to stick. You can go to the Federal Department of Education website and look at statistics in Montana. You can pick any school district. I plugged in Hellgate High School where I went to school. And the they'll have nice little pie charts of, you know, who was subjected to expulsion, suspensions in school versus out of school. You can even see disparities there, that when white kids get suspension, it's usually in school, and when kids of color get it, it's usually out of school. There was something else I was going to say about that. Oh, so the disparities in discipline for Native kids are really stark. One of the things that I think is forgotten in Montana, I mean, like Judith said, we have black people in Montana. Because the absolute numbers are so small, a lot of times people don't really pay attention to it. But in the incarceration system in Montana, the incarceration rate for blacks is even much starker than for Native people. So for whites, 425 out of 100,000 white people in Montana are incarcerated. That's the incarceration rate. For Natives, it's 1,900 out of 100,000. For blacks, it's 3,600 out of 100,000. So we have to, just because the numbers are small, we have to remember what the rates are. And I noticed that just picking a few schools, that disciplinary rates look like that often in many schools, including my high school of Hellgate, for black kids. There may only be one or two.
That's the school-to-prison pipeline.
And that's the school-to-prison pipeline, exactly. So, you know, one of the reasons, I mean, like I said, this issue of education was identified by the communities that we've worked with. We also are working with parents in Crow and students at MSU Northern who've all raised issues relating to equity and how Native kids are pushed out or, you know, treated in the schools. But I was so happy that that was identified, because I do feel like that's one way of getting at the incarceration problem. I did want to tell, in terms of changing the narrative, tell one story that I think, like I said before, really illustrates the combination, the potent combination of race and poverty in terms of people ending up in the incarceration system. So we got a story came to us through Meg about a Native kid who was from grew up on a reservation but was homeless in Billings at the time. He was arrested for theft of stolen goods worth less than $200, which was a misdemeanor, and it was a first-time offense. He was homeless, so he missed 3 court appearances. I don't know if he even knew about them. This was then turned into a felony charge of contempt of court. I've been told that there is no such thing as a felony. Is there? That's supposed to be a misdemeanor. But I have a screenshot that I took of his prison record, because you can look them up. And in the Yellowstone Detention Center, and it says felony contempt of court, and it was $10,000 bond, which, of course, his family couldn't afford. They don't even have a car.
They stack them,
and then it becomes a felony. Thank you. Yeah. I always wondered how that happened. So when they picked him up on the street in Billings,
then there are pardons available for people who are in contempt of court.
Oh. Yes. Gee, who gets that?
Presidential pardons.
Yeah. Great. Great. Interjection there.
It's felony.
Right.
Continue.
So
please.
He was thrown into jail. This on the felony, of course, couldn't pay the $10,000 bond, and was then raped while in jail. They then put him in solitary confinement. We helped find him a lawyer, and he got out. And he's now on probation and has to meet with a probation officer in Billings. He's back home on the reservation, and he doesn't have a car. So he has to hitchhike to get to Billings. And you can just imagine, you know, is he going to be able to make all the meetings? Is he going to meet the conditions? And if not, he's going to get thrown in prison, and
violation,
who knows
probation.
If he'll ever get out. Violation, exactly
it's
what we're talking about.
Criminalization of poverty.
Yeah, and it was so striking to me because the kid is like 21 or 22, same age as my son. You can just imagine how it would have come out with a white kid with two parents who are lawyers. I mean, remember where it started. It was first time misdemeanor.
And the other piece to that is now they can't find jobs, they can't find housing, they can't get into school, so their life is pretty much done. I know this because I am in housing, Section 8 low-income housing, and I get plenty of people coming through there that have been in these situations, maybe have a felony, looking for housing. I break all the rules. Anyway, but there are a lot of people that will not. No matter what their story is, you have a felony. Sorry, can't help you. And I mean, it's just, it's what do they call it? Systematic. You know, it starts with this thing and it becomes all of this. So it's you know, it starts in the school and then they go to jail and then they can't get housing.
Voting all rights.
And everything is taken away from them. Their dignity and their humanity were two things that they need to move forward are gone.
And that, yes, and that is the perfect illustration of structural racism for those people who don't exactly get what that term means. You know, think about the all of the societal and historical things that happened for this kid to be in the place of poverty where he was. And then all of these are structural things that even if there was no intentional direct racism directed against him, which I'm sure, you know, that's an assumption, but let's even assume that's true. All of these things, if you have a felony record that you can't, you know, find housing or get a job, you know, these are all just structures that are in place that perpetuate, you know, poor people and people of color getting in and staying in the criminal justice system.
So it's a great conversation. We have one comment. I want to tell you my plan, because I think 1 o'clock is our deadline, is I think we've talked about the get uncomfortable fourth directive, but not the hope directive. And I know we have Larry left a comment on this one, which is how to change the narrative. Okay. So with that in mind, did you want to offer a comment?
Yeah, I guess where I'm coming from is changing the narrative is that one of the things that was first said, I believe, by Judith is that in order to change the narrative, white people need to accept the responsibility to change these systems, which in effect we have created. I'm all about that. I don't think many white people, including myself, know how to do that. And so there's many, I just am struck by the people who have attended this, and I know other people who'd be willing to help. But to be honest, you know, we can do this and we can do that. That's great, but that's not going to create that commonality. And I think we can do it so many different ways. I would love to see something that allows us to come together and say, well, okay, this is how you can do it. Go to a class on compassion. Go to a class on mercy or something like that that allows us to get a sense. When Stevenson was here, I asked him, what is it that drives him, that motivates him over the years?
Judith and I are kind of making eyes at each other because I'm going to put a plug in. Montana Racial Equity Project does workshops in ending racism.
I want to sign up for that. I see that.
It's actually, on the back, it's all on the back table where Mary is sitting there in the pink shirt. And about our upcoming workshops and forums and the registration forms and everything.
Okay. And I think white people are more in a position to change the narrative because people are comfortable sharing that narrative as if we share it with them.
Yes.
So speaking up, getting uncomfortable to tell white people when they're propagating that narrative that that's the wrong narrative and why it's wrong, you're in actually a better position more often to change
the narrative.
And I
think white people can learn that their narrative isn't equitable. But we need those experiences and not just through one venue. Judith, I am just...
Or that narrative perpetuates inequality.
Yes. So how do we as a group or an individual change that narrative? And we can do that. But we need You know, many times we talk about empowerment, that we empower somebody else. We don't empower somebody else. We create situations. We create occasions, organizations that allow people to empower themselves. Yeah,
yeah. I want to hear Larry's comment about you haven't had your chance to talk about changing the narrative yet.
Thanks.
You might cover something.
Thank you. I'd like to talk a little bit, and I'd like to illustrate a case, an exoneration case that we've worked on recently. And I think we're going to see some of these themes. You'll recognize the themes as I tell you this short story. But to start with the end, when you think about your elected officials, think about prosecutors and how they get elected and what they stand for, and your judges when you vote for district court judges. We need good folks in those offices, and we certainly need good defense attorneys. But I want to tell you a story. This isn't so much has to do with race, although there's a tinge of or component, but it's more about something we haven't talked much about today is juveniles. And Brian spends a lot of time in the book talking about juveniles. So a young man in Missoula, and he grows up, and it's a difficult family situation. His mom, who was Native, had committed suicide in front of him. His older brother was suicidal. 2 or 3 years older, supposed to be a role model, suicidal. His father is a very antagonistic, mercurial type of a person, and the father and the sons are always at each other, always. So he acts out. His teenager acts out, and he goes to jail, and he does 30 days in the Missoula County Youth Detention Center, and he serves his 30 days, and he's released, only to find out that another 13-year-old inmate who was sharing the same pod or cell, you know, in the detention center, as they do, had accused him, Cody, of raping him the night before he was released from the jail. All the information I've told you, by the way, never went to the judge who presided over the eventual trial, and never was heard by the jury. So, as we've been talking about information that needs to justice and mercy, right? So he went to trial. He was assigned, and there was a conflict with the public defenders, so they assigned an outside attorney who wasn't versed in criminal trials, had represented criminal folks and defendants, but it was not known for going to trial. By the time it went to trial, Cody insisted all along he never did it. He wouldn't know what to do in these situations. He wasn't in the shower with this kid, and it was a farce. It was nonsense. His lawyer didn't believe him. The alleged victim testified at trial that this had happened in the shower room. 2 or 3 other kids who were in the pod had since been released. The one who was the key witness, another eyewitness, so to speak, turned out he was in lockdown at the time. He couldn't have seen what he said he saw. That information was kept from the jury. Another witness had left and could not be found. If you can believe this or not, think about fundamental fairness. A deputy prosecutor was allowed to take the stand at the trial against Cody and testify what the witness who was no longer available told him. Yes, yes. And the judge allowed it. Okay. And by the way, Cody was 17 years old, tried as an adult. You read a lot about that in Brian's book. Tried as an adult. They never had a transfer hearing, which they're supposed to have, to determine, you know, the seriousness of the offense and all that. And that became important later when Cody lost his appeals in the Supreme Court and in the so-called liberal Ninth District Circuit Court, right? And they said, well, it was inferred that the crime was serious and he was a danger to the public, so the fact that he didn't have a transfer hearing. Okay, so he loses and he goes to prison for 30 years. He gets sentenced, goes to prison for 30 years. Contacts us. At one point, he'd served prison for about 10 years and had been paroled. Committed a drug offense, went back to prison. That's an important part of the story. Had drug issues. Back in prison, contacts us, said, you know, I've heard that the alleged victim is recanted his story. He's now in prison for committing a statutory rape on a 12 or 13-year-old girl. Well, we look into the case. We discover lots of work I don't have time to tell you all about. And we go, and I interview the alleged victim. He recants. I made it up. It wasn't true. Turns out that he had a grandfather who had been in prison and had regaled his grandson, this alleged victim, with stories about how rapes occur in the prison. And the kid had turned tables and said his grandfather had raped me when he was out. Grandfather went back to prison. Don't know if it's true or not, but that information was never told to the judge or the jury. He recanted not once, twice, three times, four times to me and our staff. And we had enough information to go back and try to go to court.
Thank you.
Now, here's where the really interesting, one of the interesting parts really comes in. I get a little worked up when I talk about this. So if you know Missoula, or you know of Missoula, so the prosecutor at the time, had, in all these years that had gone by, the prosecutor Cody had since retired. His last case, his last trial, was the unsuccessful trial of a former UM Grizz quarterback who was acquitted, right? They read books about it and all that sort of thing. Now, and so that left a bad taste in his mouth as this gentleman retired from being a prosecutor. But his chief deputy prosecuting attorney had left the office a few years earlier and became a trial defense attorney, and she represented the quarterback, and it was a not guilty. Then he retired. She came back and ran for county attorney and was elected, right? And so you can imagine those two personally don't like each other. I'll leave it to you that way. So came back. We filed a petition. The judge who had presided over the trial had since retired. So we had a retired judge come in, a former judge that I knew pretty well. He came in to preside over the case. The new prosecuting attorney, there was a whole bunch of other evidence of innocence that we presented and agreed with us. This looks like this never should have gone to trial. Cody, in the meanwhile, has been in prison for 15 years. The retired judge allows the retired prosecutor to come back and testify why he thought this kid was really guilty and shouldn't be allowed out of prison. Now, it's unprecedented that that happens, right? Everybody on our board of directors and the family and everybody goes crazy. And one guy on our board is Peter Neufeld, who's a famous New York guy with Barry Shetkin. Calls us up. We can't allow this to happen. 60 Minutes wants to come in. We'll get the cameras. It'll be a nationwide story. We talk to her. We think, well, we've got the current prosecutor. Let's just see what happens. We think we're going to be okay. Hallelujah. We win. And Cody is exonerated after 15 years and he's released. Now he does pretty well. He's out for about a year. But remember, he's on parole now for that drug offense. So he still has that paper trail on parole. The parole board, in its wisdom, he's released from prison, but they parole him to Conrad, Montana. The reason he went to Conrad is because his father, the one he doesn't get along with, his invalid mother lives in Conrad, and he's there to take care of him. So imagine now you're 31 years old. You've been in prison for literally half of your life, 15 years. You're exonerated from a rape charge that a lot of people think maybe you did, maybe you didn't. And they parole you to Conrad to live under the same roof with your father, who you don't get along with, and your invalid grandmother. And what's there to do? You have no job. You have no skills. You can't drive a car. You can't run a computer. You can't do anything. It's a recipe for disaster. Talk about systemic changes and changing the narrative. And the Department of Corrections refuses to allow him to transfer his probation or parole to Missoula, where we have a basket of services to help with our exonerees. Nope, you're staying in Conrad. Well, you know, after about a year, it goes bad, and he gets involved in a misdemeanor fight in the parking lot, and he does the wrong thing, and he runs. And you might have seen it in the paper just a week or two ago, he got arrested in Deadwood, South Dakota, and they brought him back. And he faces going back on a parole revocation. So when you talk about hope and when you talk about the narrative and changing things and all that information that wasn't presented to the court or his attorney, this isn't, you know, you read Brian's book and you think these things in Alabama must be taking place in the 1930s or 40s. They're not, Rabbi. They're current. They're the 80s, 90s, and they're now. And that's a story of when you think about hope and mercy, but justice. For this poor young man who faces now going back to prison, the only real life he's known, and he might go for 5 or 6 years. I'd like you to think about those things. And when you read stories in the paper about how the justice system works, think about those things as well.
Thank you. Rabbi, if you can stay for 1 minute or if you can't, we understand. But hope is the last thing we were going to talk about. I was going to ask you for a 30-second comment on hope so we don't leave entirely depressed. You start,
oh my God!
30 seconds. Can you do 30 seconds?
If I tell you 30, it's going to be a minute. That's why I said 30.
So I'm going to do this one with my rabbi hat on. I mean, I think all good religion has as its one of its principal goals giving hope, and hope comes from the belief that we can make a difference and we can change it, and it hearing these stories can really lead us into a place of questioning whether we can make a difference and whether we can change it. Hope says we can.
Thank you. Caitlin?
Yeah, I mean, it's up to us. We only need to feel hopeless if we don't try to do anything. I mean, a lot of people have said to me, what's it like working at the ACLU since the election? There's all these horrible battles. I feel hopeful every day because I go to work and we have this amazing team and we just feel like we're doing stuff and it feels good. And I did want to say that in terms of the death penalty in Montana, there's reason to be hopeful. We have had a moratorium on the death penalty. We won legally this moratorium on the use of the lethal injection protocol in Montana in 2015. We haven't had an execution in Montana for a decade, right?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
At least 10 years. And federally, the U.S. Supreme Court has been taking steps to protect juveniles from the death penalty, protect mentally ill people from the death penalty. It's not perfect, but it's making the right progress forward. And I just want to say, Republicans have finally, and conservatives have understood the problems with the system of mass incarceration. For most of them, it's about cost. That's okay. You know, we work with people on both sides of the aisle as the ACLU, and there were a lot of reforms that were passed in Montana this past legislative session.
Abolition is forthcoming.
That would be permanent on the death penalty, but other reforms have happened in Montana, and you can read about them on our website.
Larry?
If you'll excuse me, I have to be somewhere. Thank you all.
Well, I'll talk. The best way I can talk about hope is to again reference Bryan Stevenson. In his book, he says it all the time at the end of almost every chapter, and that is, there's work to be done. We all have work to be done. We can all play our roles. The fact that you folks are here, I think, is a tremendous thing, and I think you recognize the work that some of us on the panel do, and boy, we can't do it without you financially and every other way. There's work to be done, and we're going to keep doing it.
Thank you. Judith?
Yes, two things for hope. One is that I have hope in restorative justice as far as the school and prison pipeline. The school to prison pipeline in the schools, many high schools are starting to institute a restorative justice system. I can't really explain that to you right now. Google it. Restorative justice, especially as far as high schools go. My other hope is that Montana Racial Equity Project, we have some really wonderful, wonderful, very talented volunteers who bring stuff to the table, who are really, really dedicated to interrupting racism, bigotry, and prejudice whenever they see, hear, or read it. They've gained skills and abilities, and they learn so much, even through our workshops and through our panels. And so, and we're in great demand around the state. So that's where my hope is that white people are starting to get their act together. Yeah.
Thank you.